This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. And this is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, November 21st, 2019. Ahead this hour, anthropology can often be a study of people who have been gone for a long time. Todd A. Surville, the head of anthropology at the University of Wyoming, has done research on civilizations from centuries ago, but he's also observed nomadic people in Mongolia to better understand how people might have lived in the past. He recently delivered a Stigler lecture on the University of Arkansas campus, and while he was here, he came to the Carver Center for Public Radio. The differences and similarities of two very different kinds of anthropology ahead on this edition of Ozarks at Large. This weekend on the TED Radio Hour, we're all humans and view love through our personal experiences, but how much control do we have over our feelings of affection? Sunday afternoon, exploring ideas around love, if we have agency over who we fall in love with, and how we can choose to fall out of it. The TED Radio Hour, Sunday afternoon at 1 on 91.3 KUAF. Today is the final day of scheduled public hearings connected to the impeachment inquiry in the House of Representatives. While there very well may be more live coverage from NPR of events in the approaching weeks and months, we do expect to resume regular weekday programming tomorrow. That means 1A, Fresh Air, the noon edition of Ozarks at Large, and Science Friday should all be on 91.3 tomorrow as scheduled. This is Ozarks at Large. No matter where you land on the political spectrum, you may have developed a certain level of cynicism toward our current political state of affairs. And whether becoming cynical is a logical evolution of our system or not, few people think growing cynicism among our electorate is a positive development for the country. On Saturday, I moderated a panel discussion at the Fayetteville Public Library that was part of our participation in the Purple Project for Democracy. I asked the panelists about confronting and battling cynicism, and we'll listen to that part of the discussion on this show. We'll hear from, in order, Patrick Williams, a professor of history at the University of Arkansas, Margarita Solorzano, the executive director of the Hispanic Women's Organization of Arkansas, Janine Perry, professor of political science at the University of Arkansas, and Bonnie Miller, the vice president of the League of Women Voters of Washington County. I asked the panel, as educators, organizers, and advocates, how they think we can challenge cynicism.
Some of it is what we're doing today, remedial civics, that we've grown very lazy in our citizenship, but citizenship was traditionally understood to be a reciprocal relationship that the republic offers its citizens protection and a common set of rights, and citizens owe the republic their allegiance and service. Problem these days is there's very few compulsory aspects of citizenship. Nobody drags you off to jail if you don't vote. It once was the case that adult male citizens were expected to turn out for militia training. That's why the right to bear arms could not be infringed, because Americans didn't trust a professional army. Seems to me that somehow we have lost sight of the fact of the reciprocal obligations that citizenship imposes on us. We are very jealous of our citizenship,
we can take it for granted.
We're taking it for granted, and
probably one of the things that is happening now is the polarization of the issues, and it is one political party or the other, and it's not enough compromise to address the issues and actually resolve the issues. So there is the apathy of the people. Why should I participate if it's no change? Mm-hmm. Besides having the election day on a Tuesday, for every working person, they're not going to lose the day to go and cast a vote. They have more immediate needs to address than electing someone who may not be even aligned to the to their views. Maybe with the young people also, the apathy, or maybe we are not using the right tools to get to the to that population. And again, the more immediate needs are a priority. Young people don't have the accumulated wealth to be more engaged, to participate, and the time, because there are so many responsibilities, so many priorities for young people that be active in the political system may not be one of them.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say, I'm trying to do better at with the youngest people, since that's who I interact with most of every day, is I'm trying to scold them less and encourage them more. I'm just trying to meet them where they are. And to also, I make fun of people my age who don't vote in local elections or that kind of thing. So I point out to them that they're really not any different than the generations that came before them. Or when it comes to the most local elections, than all the other adults who are wagging a finger in their face. To try to shame them into something else. They know that they are facing enormous problems. What they need is help, and they need tools, and they do it with a little bit of a, like an edgy sense of humor. But I'm trying now to approach them that way.
I will say that there are so many issues that it can feel overwhelming, right? And so we just result to this apathetic state. And I think what sometimes helps is to give people specific goals, or something like establishing an IRC. That's something specific that we can work toward, instead of just, you know, let's just strengthen democracy. That sounds great. What does that mean at the end of the day? What are we actually doing? Well, we're going to finally ratify the ERA. We're going to establish this independent redistricting commission. We are, you know, having very specific goals, I think, where we can plug people in can help overcome some of that apathy.
An excerpt from a panel discussion held at the Fayetteville Public Library Saturday afternoon as part of KUAF's and Ozarks at Large's participation in the Purple Project for Democracy. We heard from Patrick Williams, a professor of history at the University of Arkansas, Margarita Solorzano, the executive director of the Hispanic Women's Organization of Arkansas, Bonnie Miller, the vice president of the League of Women Voters of Washington County, and Janine Perry, professor of political science at the University of Arkansas. We will hear more from that discussion on a future edition of Ozarks at Large.
Welcome to 60 Second Civics, the daily podcast of the Center for Civic Education. I'm Mark Gage. The president has the authority to negotiate treaties, but the Senate has the power to ratify treaties with a two-thirds vote. Conflicts between the federal government's treaty power and the rights of states surfaced almost immediately after the Constitution was ratified. For example, the Treaty of Paris of 1783, which ended the Revolutionary War, gave British creditors the right to collect debts in the former colonies. In Ware v. Hilton, 1796, the Supreme Court ruled that the Treaty of Paris trumped a Virginia statute that permitted anyone owing a debt to a British creditor to discharge the debt by instead paying into the Virginia Treasury. That decision began a trend of using treaty-making powers to limit the powers of the states. One of the best-known cases is Missouri v. Holland, 1920, a case involving the validity of a statute Congress enacted to implement the Migratory Bird Treaty. The goal was to prevent large-scale hunting of particular species of birds during the spring breeding season. The state of Missouri argued that protecting birds was one of the police powers of the states. The Supreme Court rejected Missouri's argument. The court in this and later cases held that state law is preempted if a state rule interferes with the conduct of foreign affairs by the national government. That's all for today's podcast, 60 Second Civics, where civic engagement only takes a minute.
And the theme music for 60 Second Civics is provided by Cheryl B. Engelhart. You can find her online at cbemusic.com. The song featured there is Cheryl B. Engelhart's Complacent, which you can find on Apple Music, along with all of Cheryl's music. We are playing 60 Second Civics on November's Ozarks at Large as part of our participation in the Purple Project for Democracy. You can find out more at purplefordemocracy.org. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and President Bill Clinton are making appearances in Little Rock this week. A conference on domestic economic policy took place at the Clinton Presidential Center yesterday and included remarks from Secretary Clinton and President Clinton. Among the conference's events were panel discussions on inclusive economic growth and supporting underserved communities, moderated by both Secretary and President Clinton. President Clinton is also scheduled to speak at the Arkansas Democrat Gazette's dinner celebration tonight at the Little Rock Statehouse Convention Center. The celebration will honor the 200-year history of the Arkansas Gazette. The Arkansas Democrat Gazette, of course, is now the paper. Before the papers merged in 1991, both the Arkansas Democrat and the Arkansas Gazette chronicled President Clinton's political career for over a decade. The Arkansas Razorback women's basketball team, now ranked 20th in the country, are now 5-0 after last night's 91-60 victory over Belmont. Up next, the first game away from Bud Walton Arena this season, a Sunday afternoon contest at California. After that, it's a Thanksgiving weekend tournament in the Bahamas, and the next home game is Saturday, December 7th against Kansas State. And the John Brown University men's soccer team in Kentucky for a first-round match in the NAIA tournament. Tomorrow afternoon, JBU faces Southeastern University out of Florida. The winning team from that match advances into the second round against the number 5 national seed, Lindsey Wilson. That match will be Saturday afternoon, also played in Kentucky.
It's time for the annual KUAF and Friends Holiday Giveaway, your chance to win a gift from one of many generous underwriters. Participants include Walton Arts Center, Arcega's Coffee, Center Street Mercantile, and others. Winners announced December 13th during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. KUAF.com to register. Support comes from Heartwood Gallery and Artist Cooperative, offering handmade gifts including jewelry, pottery, plus 2 and 3D art. Holiday open house is November 30th, 5 to 8, with live music and refreshments. Located at 428 South Government Street, Fayetteville. Heartwood Gallery on Facebook or 444-0888.
Support KUAF and celebrate the season at All Drinks Considered. It's Sunday at Holidays, a pop-up cocktail venue at 18 East Center Street in Fayetteville. Meet and mingle with KUAF staff and fellow public radio fans with custom cocktails and food by Persephone on Wheels. A portion of the evening's proceeds go to support your public radio station. Come be merry with us, KUAF Holidays on Facebook, for more information.
Time now for another edition of the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. I'm Paul Gatling. On today's program, a conversation with Governor Asa Hutchinson. He's term limited and will not be running for re-election in 2020, but that does not mean he won't be in campaign mode. Late last week, the governor kicked off the Vote for Roads, Vote for Issue 1 campaign. Next November, Arkansas voters will vote yes or no on Issue 1, and that's whether to approve a permanent extension of a half-cent sales tax that is set to expire in 2022. The half-cent sales tax is expected to raise about $205 million each year for the state and roughly $100 million for cities and counties. It's part of a larger highway funding package approved earlier this year in the Arkansas legislative session. Here's the governor now discussing Issue 1 with Roby Brock.
Where do you think public opinion stands today for supporting this tax?
Well, actually, did some polling on that issue before we made the announcement, and it was about 62% of Arkansans either will vote for or probably vote for Issue 1, which is the extension of the half-cent sales tax. And so we were very pleased with that, but it still indicates you got to run a campaign because those that probably you want to make sure they have all the facts and will actually vote for it.
Will there be a map out there that kind of details where the spending is going to be? That seems to be a pretty crucial component of previous campaigns to build public support for this.
It is, and the Highway Commission and Highway Department has developed already a rough as to what this would mean in turn, this $205 million over 10 years. That's over $2 billion that would be spent on highways and where that could be spent. Now, they're also going to have public hearings on this, and that's important because we want the public to understand what the tentative plan is, but also we want to hear their comments, and there could be some adjustments on the priorities based upon that. But clearly, one thing that's important is that it's in every part of the state. We want every part of the state to benefit from this highway plan.
You're talking populated areas and maybe more rural areas?
Both, absolutely. I mean, you look down at the South Arkansas, and the east-west corridor is very important there, and that's part of the plan. You look at the north part of the state, the extension of Highway 412. So all of these different corridors, you will be able to see on how the highway department would expect to start spending that money. The other critical element is the cities and counties. If this doesn't pass, the cities and counties actually lose $43 million.
And why is that?
Well, it's because right now that half-cent sales tax has been going to them for the last 6 or 7 years.
And it goes away.
So theirs would be cut, as well as the state bond program.
There's a little incentive for them right there on that. Tell me, you mentioned cities and counties. What are some coalitions that you know will be for you on this? What are some coalitions or groups that you expect to oppose?
Well, in terms of the groups for it, I mean, this impacts every industry in Arkansas, from tourism that depends upon roads to agriculture, whether it's poultry or whether it is the farm-to-market commodities in eastern Arkansas that really, really need a road program. But it's also about the small businesses. We had one small business, Emily's Flowers from Lone Oak, that came in there. They have a flower shop, but they were delivering flowers across the county and they ran into a pothole. And that did damage to their vehicle. That was an incentive for them. They became a contributor to this campaign.
Gotcha. So
potholes do magic for supporting roads.
You have had some Democratic support for this program in the legislature. Filing period has closed. There are some of those Democrats that supported you on this highway plan, not to mention tax cuts, as well as Arkansas Works that have Republican opponents this year. Are you going to be out campaigning against some of these Democrats that have been pretty positive on your agenda?
Well, you're absolutely right. The highway plan was passed with bipartisan support, and the polling information shows that really Republicans and Democrats at the same level support the highway plan. And so I think this is something that our candidates, both Democrats and Republicans, will be supporting, hopefully. And I think they would be remiss if they didn't with those numbers. In terms of my campaigning, I wanted to be able to devote my priority to issue one, getting this highway plan passed, because I think this is fundamental to where we want to go as a state in terms of growth. It is long lasting. It can really, it is a permanent solution to a long standing problem.
So it sounds like to me you're not going to get involved in some legislative races?
I don't have any plans to get involved in legislative races. I might make some endorsements, but I have actually made in one or two races, I always try to resist getting involved in primary races.
Well, I'm talking about general election races.
Oh, general election races. Sure, I'll be supporting our Republican candidates in general election.
Even against some of those Democrats that have been supportive of your agenda?
It's all a matter of degree and the candidates, but they understand that, the Democrats that supported me in so many different ways, they support the Democratic nominee. I'm a Republican. I support the Republican nominee. Now, at the same time, I have a high regard for so many of the Democrats that supported this plan, but I'm a Republican. I'll be supporting the Republican nominee. But in terms of my campaign efforts, I want to be focused on issue one.
That's Governor Hutchinson talking highway funding and issue one. It'll be on the ballot in 2020, so I'm sure you will be hearing much more about that proposal over the next several months. There's more news after the break. You're listening to the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report.
Support for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report is provided by Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas, The Chamber's mission is to promote a pro-business, free enterprise agenda and prevent legislation, regulation, and rules that hinder business. ArkansasStateChamber.com. First Security is proud to be only in Arkansas. They offer smart solutions for personal and business banking, plus convenient services and community investment. First Security. Member FDIC. Equal housing lender.
A group of four radio stations based in Springdale is in the process of changing owners. Horn Broadcasting LLC, that's led by Candace Dixon Horn, said it will pay $3.4 million for the four radio stations that make up Hog Radio. That's 96.7 The Coyote, Star 101.5, ESPN 99.5, and Light 106.5. ESPN also has a simulcast on 1290 AM that is part of the deal. Dixon Horn is the general manager of those stations. She said the transaction should close early next year, pending approval by the Federal Communications Commission. The stations are now owned by Bunyard Media Group, owned by South Arkansas businessman Jay Bunyard. And at the Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville, Taylor Harrison Spiegel has been promoted to fill the position of Vice President of Development. Spiegel has served as the interim director since January, following the departure of Missy Kincaid. For more headlines, remember to follow our reporting online at both talkbusiness.net and nwabusinessjournal.com. And that's all the time we have for today's edition of the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. Until next time, I'm Paul Gatling. Thanks for listening.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda, and I am joined now by Leah Uribe, an associate professor of music at the University of Arkansas. Welcome back.
Hello, Antoinette. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you. Excited about this week of great music.
What do we got?
So let's start with the University of Arkansas Opera Theater.
Okay.
This is a collaborative effort of the Department of Music and Theater and the University of Arkansas Children's Choir. Such a beautiful ensemble.
Uh-huh.
They will be presenting a fairy tale about siblings and their encounter with an evil witch after getting lost in the dark forest. This is Hansel and Gretel.
Okay.
Yes. So this opera that has been adapted to a more contemporary context.
Mm-hmm.
So super exciting. This has been directed by our music professor, Dr. Hyun Kim, who has been working with voice majors through the semester. And also, Laura Chatkis is the stage director.
She's cool.
An MFA graduate from the University of Arkansas. And then choir director, Rachel Cornett. Between the three of them, this will be a fabulous event, family-friendly. And this is going to happen on November 21st and 22nd. This is Thursday and Friday at 7:30 p.m. This event is free and open to the public. And this is at the University Theater at the Fine Arts Building. If you're wondering, parking is available. And this is true for this event and any other event at the university at the Stadium Drive parking garage. And that is adjacent to the Fine Arts Building. So that would be something really fun to attend with your whole entire family.
Oh, yeah.
Also, the Anderson and Rowe piano duo. This is Greg Anderson and Elizabeth Rowe, two pianos, four hands. This is part of the Van Cliburn concert series at Crystal Bridges. They will be performing music by Coldplay, The Beatles, and many other favorites from the classical and pop repertoire. At Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Bentonville on November 22nd, Friday. The tickets are $45 or $36 if you're a member, and $10 for students. You can register on Facebook. We have a link in our page, and or by calling guest services. This is two amazing piano players. They are Emmy nominated, and they have five albums out there that have topped charts. The San Francisco Classical Voice says this is the most dynamic duo of this generation. So that will be something not to miss on November 22nd, Friday at Crystal Bridges. November the 25th, this is Monday at 7:30 p.m. at the Faulkner Performing Arts Center of the University of Arkansas, we have a joint concert by the Wind Symphony and the Wind Ensemble. And this is really exciting. They're joining this time and place, but they are all also bringing just really cool repertoire. So let's start with the Wind Symphony, conducted by Ben Lorenzo and Jamal Duncan. They are going to present several pieces. One of them is by Jennifer Jolly, which is a composer, American composer, that wrote this piece called Motordom, which is inspired by a light installation from L.A. And they will have a visual media performing as well during the concert. And that's going to be really, really cool to experience.
Oh, yeah. I love when stuff gets mixed together with art and music. It's more, I don't know, more entertaining?
More interactive, and then you have other places to look at.
I look at a lot of things, so I think it's helpful for me.
I think it's helpful for many people. In the same program, the Wind Symphony will be performing pieces by Brahms and Tilman Susato, and both transcriptions for band. The second half will be the Wind Ensemble, directed by Chris Knighton. And this also is a really, really interesting collection of pieces. They are going to start by a piece by Icelandic pop artist Björk.
Oh.
And this is from the movie in which she also stars as an actress, Dancer in the Dark. And this is from the music she wrote for the film. It's going to be presented as a very powerful brass overture. Also in the program, there will be a piece by Spanish composer Oscar Navarro. The title of this piece is Downy Overture, and he describes this piece as a fusion between his experiences as a resident of L.A. and also his native Spain. So a little bit of Latin America, literally, experiences right there. Also in this program, William Grant Steele, which was a composer, the dean of American composers. He originally was born in Mississippi but lived in Little Rock for quite a few time. This piece is titled Three Visions, and it's a musical representation of heaven. And then to end the program and the concert on the 25th, they will be featuring a Chinese composer, Zhu Tian, who teaches at Michigan State University. And the title of this piece is Petals of Fire, based on a painting by American artist Cy Wombly.
Hmm.
So really diverse composers and compositions and kind of going through different moods. It's going to be a concert not to miss. November 25th, Monday, at the Faulkner Performing Arts Center. Tickets are $10 general admission and $5 for students, faculty, staff, and seniors. Also, the Northwest Arkansas Community College Jazz Band having a concert at the White Auditorium. This is Northwest Arkansas Community College in Bentonville, Thursday at 7 p.m., free and open to the public. Besides this, as usual, the University of Arkansas Department of Music has a long list of several activities by our students and studios, including recitals for trombone, cello, bassoon, voice, saxophone, string quartet, euphonium, trumpet, clarinet, and even composition student. All of those will be listed if you go to our link and just look for the several events that are happening over there. And that's all I have.
Well, that is plenty.
It will be really fun.
Thank you, as always, and we'll talk to you soon.
Absolutely. Thank you, Antoinette.
Leah Uribe is an associate professor of music at the University of Arkansas.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. The University of Arkansas Clinton School of Public Service is now accepting applications for its online degree program. Public service professionals looking to advance their careers can learn without relocating or disrupting lives. Application deadline is December 1st. ClintonSchool.uasys.edu or 501-683-5228.
This is Ozarks at Large. Todd A. Surivel, an archaeologist and the head of the anthropology department at the University of Wyoming, for years practiced archaeology that is commonly called dirt archaeology, carefully digging and extracting information about past civilizations out of the earth. But some of the questions that developed around his field work in the western United States led him to a very different kind of research, observing nomadic people in Mongolia. Earlier this month, Todd came to the University of Arkansas campus to deliver the latest Stigler Lecture in Anthropology and Archaeology at the U of A. During his time here, he came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio and discussed how his work in Mongolia developed.
And I study people, but usually the people I study are dead, right? They're people from the past. So Mongolia was a huge change for me in that people were still living. This is a project in the field of ethnoarchaeology, so studying living people for the purpose of developing tools for understanding the archaeological record. And the way I made the turn from prehistoric archaeology to ethnoarchaeology was I was working on an archaeological site in Colorado in a place called Middle Park. Mm-hmm. It's a winter campsite. It was occupied at the end of the last ice age around 12,600 years ago. And we were finding thousands and thousands of stone tools, about 75,000 pieces of chipstone. And because the site was shallowly buried and relatively well preserved, we could open up big excavations and not only, you know, get all these artifacts, but look at spatial patterns and the arrangement of different kinds of artifacts and different kinds of materials, different kinds of tools. And what was really clear was there were a lot of really, really interesting spatial patterns that I could easily identify in our excavations, but understanding what they meant for past human behavior, I felt like we as archaeologists hadn't really done the homework we needed to do in order to translate from those patterns in the archaeological record to the human behavior that produced them. And in my mind, it inspired some really, really basic questions that I didn't know the answer to, where I wanted to see people, nomadic people, living today and see how they use the space in their campsites, and to think about how those decisions about where they do different activities would translate to an archaeological record in the Stone Age. So once I made that decision, you know, it was a fairly simple process of trying to find a place where I could do that research, you know. And because I was working in the temperate zone in Colorado at basically 7,600 feet in a mountain valley in Colorado, I was looking for a comparable environment and people who are still nomadic today and live a traditional nomadic lifestyle. And there aren't many places in the world where you can do that. Nomadic peoples in the world today really live in, you know, a couple of different environments. There's a fair number of nomadic populations still in the tropics, which does not serve, and in the subtropics, and it's not the best analog to the archaeology I was doing, right? Or then in the Arctic, to some extent, you still have that lifestyle, although not to the extent that you used to. And then in the subarctic and in the of Central to East Asia. So I could have really done this work anywhere from maybe Central Asia, from, you know, Afghanistan all the way up to Russia and Siberia. It was finding the right place and the right people in that space where I could actually do this work. And that's how I landed on Mongolia. You know, it was politically easier than, say, working in Afghanistan or Iran, right? In terms of the paperwork and the red tape of bureaucracy, easier than working in Russia, right? I had colleagues who had done archaeology in Mongolia. So I chose Mongolia. In Mongolia, you still have quite a few people who live nomadic lifestyle, and some variation of nomadism, usually associated with herding of livestock. I heard that in far northern Mongolia, there was a population of reindeer herders. Most of Mongolia, you know, the livestock that are commonly herded are sheep and goat, camel, horse, and cattle. But when I learned that there were reindeer herders in far northern Mongolia, I thought, I got to see that. That's the place I got to go. And that's how I ended up in the Sayan Mountains near the Mongolian border with Russian Siberia.
How do you work the contacts to go there and then, you know, win confidence or approval to observe?
It was really tough, actually.
I imagine.
There's so many hurdles to doing that. You know, I sort of pulled this project out of a hat. I didn't have contacts up there. First thing I did was I tried to learn the language, and Mongolian language in and of itself is really difficult to learn because, one, it's a different alphabet. It's a Cyrillic alphabet, so you need to learn to read and write again. And even more difficult, nobody teaches it. There's only one class, I think it's at Indiana University, has courses in Mongolian language, and I'm not there. I'm at the University of Wyoming. There's no Rosetta Stone, there's no online app or anything for learning Mongolian, right? So first thing I did was I found a graduate student at the University of Wyoming in the botany department, Bujidma Borhu, and she tutored me in the language for a year and a half. And she was a great teacher, and one day I was over at her house getting my Mongolian lesson, and she said, Todd, there's a Doha family that wants to work with you. Now, the Doha are these reindeer herders that, you know, I had never met, the people I wanted to go live with and study. And here I am in Laramie, and she says, there's a Doha family that wants to work with you. And I said, Buji, how's that possible? Well, her older sister's ex-husband, his cousin, was married to a guy whose mother was Doha, but no longer herding reindeer.
Oh, my gosh.
And it's an interesting place. Mongolia is this gigantic space. You know, it's about the size of Alaska, but it's a relatively small population and very rural and very connected. I mean, there's very much a social network that extends across that entire space, right? So it's through this extended family connection. I was told that there was a family that wanted to work with me. Now, when I arrived for the first time in a reindeer herder camp in the summer of 2012, it wasn't exactly what I was expecting. The welcome wagon wasn't there, and you know, when I walked into the first teepee, what they call an ortsengir, and I was like, "Hey, I'm here," and their response was basically, "Who are you? What?"
it's a difficult place to hear that.
Yeah, after traveling halfway around the world, and I can tell you how difficult it is just to get to that place geographically. They didn't know I was coming. They'd never heard of me. They didn't know what research I wanted to do or why, and they weren't exactly welcoming. And for good reason. I mean, some random person just showed up at your doorstep saying you wanted to study them and collect all this data about you, right? Out of the blue, your reaction would be pretty much the same. So it took a while to develop those relationships. But I find that if you're nice to people and you show genuine interest in them and care about them, then it opens the doors to a lot of things, you know.
How long were you there?
My first field season was the summer of 2012. My last field season was the fall of 2017. And I think in total I had six field seasons over 8 months. So I spent 8 months in the taiga, and every season. I've been there in the heart of winter, spring, fall, summer.
You used the words dirt archaeologist when we began this conversation. What tools and what sort of mental facilities are different for you when you're not looking at dead people, but living people? Was there anything that was the same?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, I'm an archaeologist. I deal with the material world. We all do. We deal with artifacts. We deal with features like fire pits and architecture. And certainly when I'm, you know, in Mongolia, or really all the time, I'm looking at the material world in which we live. So a really dumb example, in Wyoming, if you're out in the plains, you find features that we call stone circles or teepee rings. And these are, you know, exactly what they sound like. They're maybe 20 feet in diameter rings of stone that once held down the edge of a teepee for nomadic plains people. You go to a Doha reindeer herder camp, they're also living in similar house forms, and you can see teepee rings in use today, which is pretty wild. The basic tools of the research were very different. Recording human behavior as it's occurring in front of you is very different than recording it in the ground archaeologically. And my primary tools of data collection, what I was doing was mapping people as they went about their daily lives. So imagine you're in a reindeer herder camp and you want to know where everybody is and what they're doing, and you want to know that for every, say, in 2 minute intervals with great precision. How do you pull that off? So that was a technical challenge that I had to figure out.
It sounds as if you had to be on all the time that you...
It felt like that at first, but no. Imagine being in a camp at Treeline at, say, 7,000 feet above sea level in the mountains in Mongolia, and you're living in this camp with 8, 9 other people. And the closest other people to you are maybe 25 miles away. It's a pretty relaxed environment once you get accustomed to it. In fact, there's endless free time. So there's lots and lots of time to kill. My data collection methods were such that, you know, when you're living with people in a small group setting like that, one of the most important things is that you don't constantly annoy them, right? You don't want to become a problem. You certainly don't want your presence to affect the way that they're living their life, because that's what you're there to study, you know? So we developed data collection methods that were minimally obtrusive, and, you know, only 5 times a day really was I going into people's houses and collecting data for 20-minute intervals, and that was very much an intentional choice, because imagine if I followed you around with a clipboard every day for a month, right? You'd hate me. You'd want me to go away.
Or at least start acting the way I might not normally.
Yes. So in terms of being on, I mean, you're present the whole time, but there's just a lot of hanging out, a lot of downtime, a lot of walking, a lot of hiking, a lot of reading, a lot of trying to figure out things to do once you've read everything you brought with you. Your cell phone doesn't work, right? It's really relaxing that way, actually.
Did you get some of the answers that were originally formed from your curiosity?
I mean, yes and no.
Yeah.
Imagine. Let me go back to the archaeological problem and sort of describe, you know, the kind of problem that inspired me to do this work, and then I'll go back to the Mongolian case. One very common thing we find in the archaeological record is something called a hearth-centered activity area, and all that means is there was a fire, right, and people worked around that fire. And in the archaeology I do, which is hunter-gatherer archaeology before food production, very commonly we'll find, you know, fire feature, hearth feature, surrounded by stone tools, because hearths serve as magnets for human activity, because, well, you can use them to cook, they generate heat, they generate light. That's why when we make a campfire, we sit close to it, right? So that basic process is pretty well understood, but imagine now the distribution of stone tools that accumulates around that hearth feature and how it might vary and why. Let's say you want to sit around a hearth feature and make a stone tool. Where are you going to sit, and how are you going to make that decision? How close to it are you going to sit? At what angle? If you repeat that act 100 times, would you always sit in the same place? If it was inside of a house, how would that differ from outside? I didn't know the answer to any of those questions, and yet those really simple spatial decisions that we make about where to do things very much govern the spatial patterning that we see in the archaeological record. And honestly, I still, you know, before I went to Mongolia, I felt nobody knew the answers to those questions. They're really, really, really simple questions. So when I went into, you know, Mongolian households, again, these are teepees, conical lodges, 28 poles and a canvas covering, and one room, circular spaces, right? I didn't really have expectations. I knew what the distributions of stone tools looked like in the sites that I had looked at, and there were some things about them that kind of perplexed me, but I didn't really know how people would use a space like that, how behavior would be mapped onto a space like that. Now I have a really, really good idea, because I've recorded something like 5,000 human locations inside of these houses, and I've done it by age of individual and gender and time of year and time of day and different activities. So now I have a really, really good sense of how people use these spaces and why, and the general factors that govern them. So that part I understand really well now, at least for the Mongolian case, right? The next step, intellectually, logically, is challenging, right? To what extent does what I see in the Mongolian world translate to, say, Colorado 12,600 years ago or any other hearth feature in the archaeological record?
Yeah.
That's the challenging part. But I think there are some basic things that do translate. So here's an example. In the hearth features we looked at in Colorado, three of those hearth features occurred within structures, within houses, right? You wouldn't, the small circular houses of nomadic people, they were possibly conical, maybe dome-shaped, we don't know. The highest densities of artifacts appear to occur in the backs of those houses, door, away from the door, which I didn't know what that meant. I think I have a better sense now, but again, that kind of pattern inspired these questions, right? So I go to Mongolia, and when I'm there in the summertime, the first thing I notice is that when people are doing things that require the use of tools, like they're sewing or they're making something using scissors, or they're cooking, they're cutting meat, they're actually usually sitting in towards the front of the house, which is interesting. It was the opposite of what I was seeing in the archaeological record, right? But then when I went back in the fall of 2014, I noticed a lot of those activities were moving, had migrated towards the back of the house. And what I very quickly realized was that the distribution of certain activities was tracking the amount of light in this houses and in these houses and the distribution of light. So we had brought a handheld light meter so we could measure light in the, across the entire space. And in the summertime, when the door is open, it's really, really bright right in the front of the house. But in the cold season, the door is closed, that becomes one of the darkest spaces in the house. In the back of the house, where the light's coming through the top vent, the back of the house is a little better lit. And it seems really obvious after the fact, right? Like when you think about where you read, you always go to the bright places, right? But then you start to think about, okay, what was the distribution of light in these prehistoric houses and how was that controlling the distribution of activities? And am I actually seeing a seasonal signature here in the archaeological case in terms of where those artifacts are accumulating around those hearth features? So that's one simple example.
When you would come back from a field study and the cell phone worked everywhere, and there was so much, would that be a bit of an adjustment for you?
Such a great question. Yeah, so when I'm up in the taiga in Mongolia, I have no email, you know, no access to email, no text messages, no Facebook, no Instagram. I do get a little news through satellite television. These guys are packing around satellite receivers on reindeer and satellite dishes and things, but it's very isolating, right? And when I'm, you know, when we're done with this interview, no doubt I'm going to pull out my smartphone and check my email, right? So what one thing that amazed me always when I came out of the taiga and I got my first Wi-Fi, which was, you know, like a week later when we got to a town called Murung, and I checked my email and there were like 1,500 messages for me, and it seems incredibly overwhelming, right? One thing I recognized was that 99% of them could be ignored. And then I wondered, you know, it makes you wonder, like, why are we doing this all the time? Why are we so attached to this stuff and these forms of communication? And they bring us so much more angst than they do actually convenience. And it's a great question. It was always so striking to me, like, getting back to the internet was never like this panacea. It was always kind of disappointing.
Todd A. Surville is an archaeologist, and he is also the head of the anthropology department at the University of Wyoming. This month, he delivered a Stigler lecture on anthropology and archaeology at the University of Arkansas. We spoke with him at the Carver Center for Public Radio.
Support comes from our Sega's Coffee Roasters and its new drive-thru location at 1509 MLK. Open 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. 7 days a week with a full menu of beverages and snacks made from scratch. Fall drinks include toasted sesame mocha, daily driver espresso, and salted maple caramel lattes. Our Sega's on Facebook for more.
Contributors to this edition of Ozarks at Large included Antoinette Grajeda, and our show was mastered by Timothy Dennis in the Harold and Blanche Cox News Studio. Our theme is written and performed by Daryl Sean. The Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report with Paul Gatling is a product of our partnership with Talk Business and Politics. Additional content today provided by KUAR Public Radio in Little Rock and Central Arkansas. Ozarks at Large is a production of 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Batavia. 91.3 KUAF is a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. You can use your smart speaker to listen to Ozarks at Large and KUAF anytime you want. Just tell that smart speaker to play the Ozarks at Large podcast or play KUAF. And if you want to hear classical music from KUAF at any hour of the day, just say play KUAF 2. Same for jazz, except then you say play KUAF 3. And of course, you can take Ozarks at Large with you by subscribing to our free podcast. Services like Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, Apple TV, Google Play, TuneIn all offer the free podcast. And yes, you can still find entire editions of our show and individual stories and interviews that you can share at our website, ozarksatlarge.com. The Mr. Rogers Neighborhood Sweater Drive, coordinated by our friends at AETN, continues through November 30th at Alma, Eureka Springs, Gentry, Gravette, St. Paul, and Van Buren Public Libraries. Sweaters, also coats, hats, and gloves collected at the Gravette Public Library will be given to the Salvation Army for distribution in Northwest Arkansas. If you'd like more information about the Mr. Rogers Sweater Drive, AETN.org. Antoinette Grajeda does a couple of things early and late that we should mention. Each weekday morning at 5:30 and 7:30, you can hear her deliver newscasts about the Ozarks in Arkansas. And late in many of our shows, late as in the end of, she selects songs to help us close out our program. For this Thursday edition of Ozark, she has picked the song Holy Winter, as performed by the Sons of Otis Malone. The Sons, along with Baird Blaine, will perform Monday at the Siloam Springs Community Building, beginning at 6:30 p.m. You can find out more information at the Facebook page for the Sons of Otis Malone. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for listening. Back tomorrow at noon and 7.
Ain't much that I can do but lay here with you and whisper in the dark to our unborn child. There's pictures of my mother and her mother and her mother. They up on the wall in the den. And I think of what they've seen and how this world can feel so mean when you're about to bring a baby in. Oh, holy winter. Blessed cold makes a body feel alive when it's just trying to survive. Lord, it's hard on the sick and the old. It's colder than it's been here in 40 some years. The pipes in a house, they all froze. Stray cats in the crawl space are serious and still, like soldiers in the trenches just before the whistle blows. Just as long as he can see. And in the summertime, that's longer than I like. When the days get short, then the guitars all come out. And the old songs of my people hang like ghosts in the night.